time for a deep dive into the one issue that matters most in a capitalist democracy, money. This is Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money, a joint production of the Maggie Dawn Show and the Patriotic Millionaires. Now, let's start talking money.
What's up, Wisconsin and beyond? I'm Maggie Dawn, host of the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Every day at 3 o'clock, we talk about money in a segment that we call Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money. Today, our very special guest is Peter Goodman. He is the economics correspondent, the global economics correspondent for the New York Times, the author of Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World. And his newest book is How the World Ran Out of Everything Inside the Global Supply Chain. So today on Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money, we're going global. We're going to talk about the global supply chain, which is this complex system that gets you everything that you need, from factories to farms to cell phones, you name it. It's probably impacted by the global supply chain. So my big hearty welcome to Peter. Thanks so much for making time for us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Very excited to talk about this. Can you tell us what the book is about and what got you thinking, oh, gee, I want to write a whole book about the global supply chain?
I never thought I would want to write a whole book about the global supply chain. It seemed just wonky and maybe even boring, although it turns out it's fascinating. But, you know, it kind of got thrust upon me. I was living in London for the first wave of the pandemic, and we had a baby born on April 8th, 2020. And my wife was pretty stoic about the fact that her parents couldn't fly over from New York to help out. And we had cooped up school age kids destroying our, you know, blissful vision of shared parental leave time. But where she lost it is we got home from the hospital and we couldn't find hand sanitizer. We couldn't find masks. And then we went online. We tried to order the ingredients to make hand sanitizer. Oh, we couldn't find those either. And she looked at me and she said, you're supposed to know, you know, how this stuff works. What's going on here? And I realized that at first I didn't have a satisfying answer to that question. And once I really got into it, it was really kind of the breakdown of the sort of globalization that we've all gotten accustomed to over decades. And as I started to write a bunch of stories for the Times about the breakdown of the supply chain, which was, you know, shipping was overwhelmed. Factories in China were overwhelmed with orders. In the States and in the UK, where I still was, we supposedly had run out of truck drivers. We didn't have enough warehouse workers. And as I got into the minutiae and figured out that it was actually pretty fascinating, I realized that it required book length to explain how this vital system broke down in our darkest hour of need.
Well, first of all, congrats on the birth of your child.
Thank you.
Over 4 years ago. And boy, that's quite a honey do list, Peter. Dear honey, please fix the supply chain so I may have some hand sanitizer with my newborn. Well, you're working on it, right? Though we do not have time to dissect your book in these brief segments here, most of us, probably, unless we went to business school or were an economist or did some wonky thing ourselves, probably didn't even hear about the supply chain, let alone the global supply chain, until COVID-19. So, you know, what is it that somebody listening at home, that and most of our folks are here in Wisconsin, if you're talking to a regular Wisconsinite, what is the couple most important things about the supply chain that you think a regular person, all you out there, need to know as we move forward past COVID? Are we only susceptible if another, you know, 100-year plague descends upon us?
No, we are definitely susceptible. There will be another shock. We don't know what it will be, but it will happen because that's how life works. It's inevitable. And it will, again, test and probably expose the deficiencies and the vulnerabilities in the supply chain. You know, look, it's sort of like the electrical grid, right? We're invited not to think about it. We don't think about power stations and giant wires. We just flip on the switch, the lights go on. Well, if the lights don't go on for millions of people in the middle of an emergency, then we do start thinking, what's going on there? Who's paying attention to this? How did this happen? Who's benefiting from the state of play that made us vulnerable to power outages? And, you know, when we can't make a ventilator in the middle of a pandemic, when we don't have PPE for frontline medical workers, when we run out of, you know, things that aren't so life and death, exercise bikes are late when we can't go to the gym in the middle of a pandemic, when today we can't build enough affordable housing in part because the supply chain can't produce enough, you know, meters to measure water and gas, that's a serious problem that bears reckoning with. Now, you're asked quickly, like, what's going on here? Here's what's going on in the quick version. We have normalized the exploitation of the unseen army of people we're depending on to make our stuff and deliver it to our doors. There are truck drivers, warehouse workers, there are people in factories in our own country, around the world, who are essentially unable to attend to their own families at anything close to a middle-class standard. Their time doesn't belong to them. You know, it's a just-in-time supply chain for companies where they're very lean with inventory and warehouses because they'd rather save the capital they might spend putting, you know, extra parts and extra products in warehouses as a hedge against trouble. They'd rather give it to corporate executives as a reward for going so just in time. Well, for the people who actually do the work, who deliver products through trucks and work in warehouses, their own time is treated as sort of unlimited and without any value. And every time there is a shock, and especially when unemployment's low and people get to contemplate, maybe there's something else out there for me, turns out we run out of workers. These worker shortages are really the story of downgrading jobs to the point at which we run out of people willing to do them. And then we can talk about this in greater detail, but financialization and the paramountcy of shareholder interests, which if, you know, this is beyond just the supply chain, this is American life in general, and much of the wealthy world, where the interests of the investor class trump all other interests. And that's a big part of the explanation for how we ran out of so much stuff.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me because back in B school, when I was there many decades ago now, you know, just-in-time supply chain management was sort of, ooh, it's this cool thing. See how low you can keep your inventory costs. And this is this, especially as AI rises in prominence, there's all sorts of applications when you think about it from a supply chain perspective. But I wanted to emphasize your first point was, it is the normalization of the exploitation of labor is what we're talking about.
That's right.
About the people that help bring products to us. You know, we saw the longshoremen, of course, on the Eastern Seaboard. They had to strike. We've observed on this show that the port companies had exploding profits that have continued to rise coming out of COVID, some 800% rise in profits. The workers that make all that possible saying, hey, can we eat two at this table? And of course, the primacy of shareholder interests. Who's benefiting? I mean, is it the shareholders or is it a particular group of shareholders? Is it the CEOs or is it sort of all of the above?
It's all of the above. It's consumers to some extent. I mean, this sort of supply chain has been thrust upon us, kind of optimizing conditions for big box retailers like Target and Walmart and now giant e-commerce players like Amazon. And the deal has always been like, look the other way on the fact that we're exploiting lots of warehouse workers and truck drivers and tapping overseas supply chains where human rights are not, you know, part of the equation, where workers can't organize, because we're going to hook you up with low cost products. And in exchange, you will also look away from or not be aware of the fact that most of the benefits of this mode of operation are going to the investor class. They're going to corporate executives who are paid in stock, who are interested in making share prices go up every quarter. But you know, there's also this idea that we can either have a really efficient supply chain or we can have a more resilient supply chain, as if these things are in opposition. You know, I just want to go back to your point about just in time, which was a great idea. Very sensible idea. This is how Toyota was organized. You know, instead of wasting lots of raw materials, run your supply chain the way a grocery store manages milk. You know, you want enough on the shelf that everybody can come in and buy milk if they want it, but not so much that you're spilling milk because it's gone bad. Well, Toyota actually did that. It worked great, but along come consultancies like McKinsey who invite companies to overdo it. Tap faraway supply chain, something Toyota never would have done, and then just, you know, hand the rewards of low prices and not much inventory to corporate CEOs as a reward for being smart enough to hire the likes of McKinsey. And where does this come down for the rest of us? Well, it turns out it's not really all that efficient. I mean, in the book, I tell the story of how the railroads did their version of just-in-time called precision scheduled railroading. I talked to an engineer for Union Pacific Railroads out in Idaho who was horrified to discover that he was actually pulling cargo to the wrong destination because Union Pacific was so intent on showing Wall Street, look, we did it. We lowered dwell time, this metric that measures, you know, how long does cargo sit in any particular place. If you lower that number, that's supposed to be a marker of efficiency. Well, some guy running the Union Pacific rail yard in Nebraska says, I don't care where the next train's going. I'm attaching as many cars to it as possible so I can lower dwell time. Meanwhile, somebody in Southern California is waiting for a car part they need that is going to Oregon instead, and it's going to take weeks to get back to them. And so it goes, that's not efficient. That's only good if all you care about is a metric that'll make share prices go up in the next quarter.
Yeah, and help CEOs reap exorbitant pay that is some thousand times greater than the average median income of their frontline workers. Folks, that's Peter Goodman. He is the New York Times global economics correspondent. He's written two incredible books. Today, we're talking about his newest book, How the World Ran Out of Everything Inside the Global Supply Chain. Peter, we talked about, and you mentioned, these two objectives when you think of the supply chain. You want a resilient supply chain and an efficient supply chain. It's often talked about as if you can only do one but not the other. Is that a myth?
Yeah, it's absolutely a myth. I mean, first of all, there's inefficiency in lack of resilience, because if your stuff is supposed to be in Oregon and instead it's on a train going to Southern California, that's neither resilient nor efficient, right? And that's what we get if we just cater to the metrics that are making share prices go up on Wall Street. But also, you know, if you want the UPS guy or the Amazon guy to show up at your door, you better think about that person's ability to, you know, deal with their children, their sick relative, to have a life outside of work so that they won't just quit when some other option comes along.
Yeah, I often think of that as they're dropping things off at 9:30 at night. My goodness. Today, we're talking about the global supply chain with my very special guest, Peter Goodman. He is the New York Times global economics correspondent and the author of a new book called How the World Ran Out of Everything Inside the Global Supply Chain. Peter, before we went to the break, we were talking about the fact that workers seem to bear the brunt of the burden of producing this efficiency in the supply chain and the profit that inures to the benefit of shareholders and CEOs, especially in modern day CEO pay where it's mostly stock-based compensation. Just today, news came out that at one of the companies located in North Carolina, six workers died, allegedly because their CEO would not allow them to leave the manufacturing floor as the floodwaters were rising. This is an extreme example.
Yeah.
But is it really? Because during the time of COVID, we looked to workers to keep these goods moving at great potential risk to themselves and their families. These were the essential workers that kept our economy, right, at least hanging on by a thread. How much are working people suffering? Are these unusual circumstances, or is this a regular thing where the workers that create these supply chain efficiencies are really the ones that bear the burden?
I mean, that's an extreme example, but it's certainly representative of the fact that, you know, I don't know who the CEO of that company is, but if that company's publicly traded, they're answerable to a board and to a broader investor class that's demanding the lowest possible costs, the greatest possible revenues, and any deviation, you know, even if the answer is, well, I was trying to do right by my employees, is an invitation to go, you know, look for their next job. I mean, in my book, I tell the story of a woman who was working at a slaughterhouse in Greeley, Colorado. This is a slaughterhouse run by JBS Foods, which is the world's largest meat packer, run by a couple of Brazilian brothers who literally spent time in prison for amassing through fraudulent means the credit needed to roll up lots of slaughterhouses, including in the United States. And this woman, Tin Ai, who was a refugee from Myanmar, her daughter was begging her not to go to this plant. It was early in the pandemic. It seemed like a potential super spreader situation. And the Trump administration had actually dropped an executive order calling workers in slaughterhouses essential workers. Now, this part of the story is probably familiar to people. Here's the part that wasn't familiar to anybody until we got hold of some documents that I lay out in the book. At the time that the Trump administration parroted the industry talking points to say, if women like Tin Ai don't keep laboring in dangerous conditions in these slaughterhouses, we are going to go hungry. The meatpacking industry was literally sitting on record volumes of frozen products, were exporting those products around the world. So basically, Tin Ai, who unfortunately was one of four workers who died in the first wave of the pandemic at this slaughterhouse, and I heard this story from her daughter cradling her then 18-month-old baby, looking at a picture of the grandmother, you know, he would never meet, she lost her life not to feed us, but to funnel monopoly profits to JBS Foods, one of four companies that controls 85% of the American beef supply. There's a lot of these sorts of stories in what we can call the supply chain of the American economy writ large. People are sacrificing supposedly for the benefit of consumers. Usually it's for the investor class.
Yeah, that's an incredibly poignant example. We know as well that very recently one of the two or three egg producers in the United States, they actually, one, culled the herd to keep egg prices artificially high, and then actually shipped eggs out of the United States to somewhere else, again, right, effectively engaging in price gouging and price manipulation. Same situation there, and that poor woman gave her life for it.
Right.
How do we make the supply chain more resilient? Can we do that, have an efficient supply chain, and compensate workers fairly?
Yeah, there are a bunch of things we need to do. One thing we need to do is have antitrust enforcement, serious antitrust enforcement. I mean, your example about the eggs gets at a point I get at through beef in my book. There's a lot of engineered scarcity in this economy where, oh, you know, there's a shock to the system, and just somehow by accident, the industry that's disrupted ends up making record profits. You know, usually disruption turns into record profits for an industry that's got a monopoly power. So we need antitrust enforcement. We should welcome labor mobilization as an opportunity for workers to get their piece of the action, which will benefit the rest of us because we'll be dealing with human beings who are more motivated to continue doing their jobs. You know, I tell the story of Henry Ford in the book. He's not somebody to be lionized. He was a racist, yes, and anti-Semite. He crushed organized labor, but he knew a thing or two about making products at scale. And he specifically, you know, he doubled the wages of his workers in 1914. Some people called him a communist. He said, no, I just want people showing up who are undistracted, who can do their jobs. And I know that any business that's premised on low wage labor is inherently unstable. So we need antitrust enforcement. We need corporate boards to do their jobs and look past short-term incentives and think about the long-term health of companies. And we need labor to get a piece of the action.
Folks, that is Peter Goodman, my special guest today on Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money. He is the New York Times global economics correspondent, author of two great books, Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World, and his newest book, How the World Ran Out of Everything Inside the Global Supply Chain. Henry Ford, a despicable human being, but his ideas about paying people well, not just enough, but well, echoed repeatedly on The Maggie and the Millionaires by a number of CEOs that have run numerous different companies very successfully. They say the key to success, long-term success, is that motivated, happy, focused workforce. And to do that, you must pay people well so that they can live with some dignity. Thank you so much, Peter.
Thanks for listening to Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money, a joint production of Civic Media and the Patriotic Millionaires. For more information, go to patrioticmillionaires.org and be sure to tell your friends. The Patriotic Millionaires buy advertising across a number of Civic Media stations.